And we're talking tonight about the spiritual gift of madness. That's right, the failure of psychiatry. We're going to be talking with both Seth Farber and Paul Levy in a moment about that on Coast to Coast AM. Seth, how do you look at psychiatry today? Is it getting better or worse?
It's getting both better and worse, but it's a cul-de-sac. It's destroying the planet. We can't, and really, it's getting worse because it's reaching more people. It's destroying more people's lives. You don't see the lobotomies like you did. It's more subtle, but it's suppressing the process. What Paul is describing is a process of what you know Buddhists or many Eastern mystics would call enlightenment. In the sense that he realized the unity of all beings, that we're all in this together. And, you know, they try to suppress that. So that's one thing. And they're, because they have such greed, which is, I think, the plague of my modern life, of modern times, which may destroy the planet, they are even, you know, getting little kids addicted to their psychiatric drugs. So in a sense, It's worse both because they're destroying more people's lives and because we're at a time now where if we're going to, humanity is either going to take the next step in our spiritual evolution or the whole planet is going to be destroyed. The greed that of the people in power who control, you know, the corporations, who control the politicians, is destroying the planet.
Okay, Paul, let's get back to you so you can finish your story with us, this incredible story. And you sound, by the way, you sound fine to me right now.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I haven't been on any sort of psychiatric medication for, what is it, like 28 years with no episodes. Yeah. And yet, you know, during the hospitalizations, the psychiatrist continually reflected back to me that I was mentally ill, that I would have this mental illness till I took my final breath, that I needed to be medicated, that if I wouldn't agree to take my medication, that I would just have more psychotic breaks. And of course, my reaction was to disagree with them, which just confirmed to them how crazy I was that I had the temerity to disagree.
Aha, that's, you know?
And it was weird because basically what my situation was when I would get hospitalized was when I would just describe, you know, from the phenomenological point of view, what my experience was, like what I was experiencing. The only thing they're trained to do is pathologize. So here it was like sort of this abnormal experience. It was a non-consensus reality experience. And I didn't have the awareness because I was so young, you know, that I didn't have the awareness that I should not really be communicating what I'm experiencing to them. And I was just very open in sharing with them what I was perceiving and what I was experiencing, which just confirmed to them, like in a negative, like self-perpetuating feedback loop, how crazy I was. And then the final thing which sealed the deal is that then as they more and more solidified their perception of me as being sick, the sicker I got, which then confirmed, then they had evidence to prove the seeming objective diagnosis. So it was like black magic.
In your opinion, Paul, are there some people out there who are sick, who are truly mentally ill?
Yeah, well, it's a twilight, you know, concept, and I mean, it's very clear that there are people who are really suffering and who are really sick, in the sense that they're deeply suffering. But when you have the realization that we're all not separate from the field and from each other, you know, yeah, we're in the middle of a collective psychosis. And so, of course, people who are sensitive are going to be, like, feeling that or they're going to be, like, embodying that or expressing that. But because psychiatry, the whole model of it is based on the separate self, then the person who's suffering, they become what's called the identified patient. They become concretized as being the one who's sick, you know, without having the deeper, like, this meta-awareness that, wait a second, well, what about, like, the family system that they're involved in, whether it be their actual parents or siblings or community or culture or species that we're in the middle of a psychic epidemic.
Seth, what percents, do we have any data that tells us how many people are in institutions, what the percent is of the population that may be perceived as mentally unstable?
I believe there are 40 million people now that are collecting disability from the government. on labeled as anyway from anxiety, mostly anxiety disorders and
40 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. If I could just say one thing, George, and that is that I'm sure that some of those 40 million, you know, I can't say what percentage, are actually having some form of spiritual awakening. And if that would have been, like, seen, and if they would have been, like, you know, for example, in cultures that were the sort of, like, indigenous cultures that, had wisdom, that were based on wisdom, they would understand when somebody's called to be some sort of a shaman, their psyche always disintegrates. It always appears like they're having a breakdown. But they would be able to discern, oh, wow, this person is having this breakdown, and they might, it might be actually towards a higher integration. So then they would actually support the person. And, you know, with the understanding that, well, this person might actually be becoming like a shaman or a healer who would have benefits for the whole tribe, for the whole community.
Do you agree with that, Seth? Go ahead.
Yeah, it was R.D. Lang, the British psychiatrist, who was said that a breakdown is the prelude to a breakthrough, or is often the prelude to a breakthrough. It's breaking down the customary ways that you have of thinking of things that keep you from receiving new things. So, that was recognized in other societies, shamanistic societies, for example.
Truly.
And,
with regards to the prescription of drugs to people, prescribing so much to them, why do doctors do that? Why is it an easy way for them?
Yeah, I mean, look, in 1978, psychiatry was losing business. They were making only like, the APA was making only like, I think, 4 or 5 million a year. They were so nervous that they were going to, one of the reasons they were losing, but they had such a bad reputation from the 60s movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And plus, you know, the Gestalt therapy and the whole humanistic therapies that emerged in the 60s, and it got a lot of press with the counterculture, so that people were tend to go to psychologists or social workers rather than a medical psychologist. So they appointed a commission to study what would be the effects on psychiatry if they were to stop taking drug company money. And that commission said the effects would be catastrophic. So not only then did the psychiatry decide not to ban money, and there were some people in the field then who had some ethics, but they decided they would accept that they would solicit more money, and that's what ended up happening. As Peter Bragan is looking, that is in the late 70s, the birth of the floodgates, as Peter Bragan said in floodgates of drug company influence were open and would grow wider each year. In 1980, the APA Board of Directors decided to throw ethical caution to the winds and solicit drug company support for major professional, for all their activities. So, to quote Peter, Dr. Bragan, whatever function APA had ever fulfilled as a professional organization was now superseded by its function as a political advocate for the advancement of psychiatric and pharmaceutical interests. That was the birth of the psychiatric pharmaceutical complex. And like the military-industrial complex, it doesn't do a good job of preventing wars, or the prison-industrial complex, which doesn't do a good job of getting people out of prison and keeping them out. The mental health system doesn't do a good job of curing people their illnesses. So that the best example is bipolar, because there's been such a soared, the number of diagnoses soared in the last couple of decades.
Oh yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
It was that diagnosis.
In 1956 or something, there were only like 16,000 bipolars. Now there are 6 million. I mean, and that's like a few years a few years ago, maybe even more. And psychiatry, it's greed. I mean, they are doing anything to build more markets. I mean, it's greed, but that's they the drug companies have the responsibility. They have no responsibility to the general public, which is what's wrong with our corporate system in America today. Public pays the cost, so all their whole thing is just to make money. And unfortunately, the psychiatrists have become, if I could use this term, but they've really become pimps for the drug companies.
Yeah. Oh,
and they're out there recruiting clients, and they're destroying the lives of people by putting them on drugs that, have a disabling effect on their mind, two, destroy their bodies because they're dying 15 to 25 years sooner than the average population, and three, of course, they're suppressing the process of spiritual evolution that I believe is the only thing that can save humanity.
Well, and now let me ask you this. I mean, how do we know, you know, with kids, for example, who post on their social networks, you know, I'm going to kill somebody, and they end up doing that. How do we know who's mentally ill and who isn't? To me, it seems very confusing.
Yeah, well, I mean, all the studies show that the, I don't know, I studied George family therapy, and I really liked it and found it was that when you have a cooperative family, you're able to solve the problem. Unfortunately, I was encouraging people to get off drugs, so I kept getting fired. But if you get a problem in the beginning, I think you have a family that's willing to help, you can have design an intervention that's going to be helpful. You don't know. There's no way of saying that this person at 8 years old is going to. That's mythology. That the 8 year old is going to grow up to become a crazy, demented murderer. I mean, they have no evidence of that at all. They're pretending they're fortune tellers when they're not. So there's really no way of predicting that. But a good, sensitive friend, let alone a good psychologist, should be able to know when they're dealing with someone who's about to explode, like James Holmes. I mean, for all we know, though, this guy could have been a subject of a mind control experiment like MKUltra.
Some people are saying that. It's as strange as it seems, as conspiratorial as it may be, some people are now beginning to say that. I didn't want to go there in the beginning out of just respect to the family and the victims. But,
yeah.
You know, this is a strange case. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, sure. Because as soon as, you know, the very moment that I heard about it, because actually that night I was up late and I got a breaking news email from whatever, and my first thought was, well, yeah, we're in the middle of a collective psychosis. Of course something like this is going to happen, which is actually, you know, I mean, of course it's totally horrible, and it's symbolic. It's showing us something. Like, it's showing us this deeper dynamic or this process that's actually happening inside the psyche of humanity, and that is that we're, to the extent that we're not, you know, connected with who we actually really are, and we're not constructively, you know, expressing in a conscious way our creative spirit, then that creativity turns inwards and turns self-destructive, you know, or other-destructive. And so what he enacted was actually a process that was happening deep inside the collective psyche. And it was a symbol that could actually help all of us to have that recognition. And when you have that recognition, oh, wow, you can wake up. So that was basically in that moment when I first heard about it, what occurred to me.
Yeah. All right, let's take some calls with both of you. We'll go first to Vicky in Zillow, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Vicky. Go ahead.
Good evening. How are you gentlemen tonight?
Good. Oh, great.
Thank you.
My question is, can you tell me, I know there's been a lot of diagnosis for in mental illness for a hyperactive frontal lobe. And can you explain
hyperactive
what that means,
what?
A hyperactive frontal lobe?
Uh-huh.
And do you know what that is?
I haven't heard a hyperactive frontal lobe yet, but I know, you know, obviously when I hear frontal lobe, I think of the lobotomies because, you know, that's what they were doing. They were severing the attachment of the frontal lobe with the rest of the brain. And so it scares me when you talk about a hyperactive frontal lobe, because I think a frontal lobe is where all the creativity is. So that, to me, it sounds like, another psychiatric agenda to suppress creative and different young people. But you may know more about it than I do.
And Vicky, how about do you have a question for us, Vicky?
To like teenage kids who they think they have attention deficit disorder, they do EEGs with evoked potentials, and they put the little hat on and they measure the responses. And sometimes, with the measurements, they can see that the hyper lobe is is active. The frontal lobe is active, and so then they want to give them psych medicine for that.
Yeah, I mean, they find any excuse to give them people the psychiatric drugs, because they're basically trying to drum up. So I mean, it used to be that people actually had to have problems, had to go to the psychologist and say, I have a problem, I'm deeply depressed. And now, in order to, I believe, to get more money, to get greater profits, they're making up things. I mean, they're going to have new diagnoses. I won't believe that there's anything pathological about a hyperactive frontal lobe, just like I don't believe that, there's a guy named John Gatto. I don't know if he's known to you, but he was a teacher for 25 years in the public schools, and his conclusion was that after 25 years, that some kids learn quicker and some learn others. Some will go until fifth or sixth or seventh grade, and they'll seem slow, and then all of a sudden they'll just blossom. So, it's really, there are just different rhythms of human unfolding. But when the psychiatrists since their agenda is not to discover the rhythms, not to potentiate the person's potential to be who he could be, his greatest self, but to put him on drugs nowadays, you're not going to find them looking for that. That you find them looking for any excuse they have. But I won't believe that there's anything pathological about it until I see it, because Paul describes experience he has in which he's, from my point of view, is an experience and his of enlightenment, and would be considered as
If I can just jump in, because I was fortunate, because during my experience, like between 81 and 82, that was also when I began to meet my teachers. So I was really, just blessed to meet some of the greatest enlightened beings of Burma and Tibet, who I'm still really, really close with. Mm-hmm. And they've been my teachers for 30 years, and I would be describing to them exactly the same experiences that when I would describe to psychiatrists, I would get pathologized, and they would be reflecting back, oh, that's great news. You're beginning to remember who you are. You're beginning to wake up. And, of course, by seeing the healthy part of me, they were invoking, that healthy part of me so I could more step into it.
Yeah, wow.
Have you ever found yourself, Paul, slipping back at all?
Oh, well, the thing to realize, keep in mind what I went through with my father, like I mentioned, my father and psychiatry, it was deeply traumatic. So I'm still healing. Just to one thing I want to mention, both of my parents passed away in the last 13 years, completely convinced with psychiatry's blessings that their only child,
right,
me, was mentally ill.
All right. Hold on, Paul. We're going to come back with you and Seth in a moment and final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll have open lines here on Coast to Coast AM, but when we come right back with Seth Farber and Paul Levy, we'll take phone calls and your stories right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Seth Farber, Paul Levy. Paul, let me ask you this. If people need to talk to their doctor about these drugs they're on, they shouldn't be taking themselves off it on their own. How did they talk to the doctor about it?
Well, it depends who the doctor is, And one thing to understand too is these drugs are so toxic that because I'm in private practice, just as far as helping other people who are waking up to the dreamlike nature. Mm-hmm. And what can happen when you take yourself off these drugs is that you can appear to to have psychotic seeming symptoms which, you know, a psychiatrist is trained to then interpret to mean, oh, well, clearly you have to go back on the drugs. But, you know, an alternative interpretation, which might even be more correct, is that, no, that's the toxicity of the drugs being released into your system. And if you can just get through that, then you could potentially get off the drugs. So it depends who the psychiatrist is, how tuned in they are and turned on they are, you know, and not under the spell of you know, of big farm, you know, of the pharmaceutical companies.
Seth, what your take? What does somebody?
By the way, I just want to correct. It's not 40 million on disability. It's just 40 million that the NIMH claims suffers from those illnesses.
Okay.
My take on how you can talk to psychiatrists about it. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's a big problem. That's a major problem, and I'm referring people more and more to. I mean, I'm hoping that it'll grow into the Mad Pride movement, the Mental Patients Liberation Movement, the Mad Pride movement. They're starting to create alternative self-help groups and so on. And, you know, and they're also, it's very hard to find a psychiatrist that is open-minded about this, both because of its, you know, I started in the 70s in graduate school. And they were not open-minded then, and they weren't trying to push the drugs across the whole population to increase their mind. They just thought anything spiritual was pathological. And, you know, in people who were labeled schizophrenic, and many of whom I became friends with, they would frequently open up the Bible, and the psychiatrist would take the Bible and tear them out of their hands. It's almost like the Inquisition, but this time it's a psychiatric Inquisition, and instead of the heretics being people with the wrong religious belief, they're people with any kind of interest in spiritual, particularly in the hospitals. Once you get labeled mentally ill, increased religiosity is listed in their diagnostic manual as a sign of illness. So, I'm hoping what will happen is they started the Hearing Voices movement in America, and it's starting to catch on here. In Europe, I have friends who are in that movement. And like in England, practically every town has a Hearing Voices network in which people can go. And the first person that I spoke of, I called him Jim, who came to me, whose parents and psychiatrist told him he was definitely schizophrenic because he was hearing the voices. I told him, I did what is now being done by groups like the Hearing Voices Network, in which it's a self-help group. I said to him, you know, there are people in California, I just got back from California, they're hearing voices too, but they call themselves channelers and make a lot of money. So the thing is, it's very hard to find psychiatrists who are going to think of spirituality, who are able to think of spirituality as a positive thing rather than a sign of mental illness. And it's very hard as psychiatrists who are going to our idol in this society is the God we worship is Mammon. It's money. We don't worship God anymore. The idolatry. So that's hard too because. I could quote you the thing in where they have the statistics in Vermont. We know that the ones that are on the take from the drug companies are pushing the drugs more. I mean, sure. So there's certain websites that people can go to, but they're going to have to build a self-help movement in this country because until psychiatrists are willing to say to help people get off the worst. Slowly get off the worst of these psychiatric drugs and not become dependent on them for life.
Well, these people who are hearing voices, Seth, what are the voices that they hear?
Well, my first client who was so-called schizophrenic, but he was the first that I was in a one-to-one therapeutic relationship with. His voice was saying pretty good things. Tim. Now, I have another friend whose voices are always saying, you're no good, you know, the kind of things that a bad parent would say, you know, you're no good, you're
a failure,
blah, blah, and continually. So that drives her crazy. Now, I think her problem, and she didn't meet me until she'd already been on psychiatric drugs for 15 years. In fact, had she met me 15 years before that, I was brainwashed myself, so I wouldn't have been able to tell her to become addicted to the psychiatric drugs. So I haven't met any, you know, if I had anyone that was voices telling them to commit some horrible crime like Holmes, I would have gotten disturbed. But that's pretty atypical. More typical is either voices that are sometimes good, sometimes bad, or voices that sound like a bad, you know, a parent, the kind of parent that you wouldn't want to have, and that, you know, that they maybe had when they were younger.
They probably did. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, the psychiatrist, C.G. Jung, actually, who developed active imagination, he literally was having these imaginary dialogues with beings inside of his head who were teaching him stuff that he didn't know. And it was through these dialogues that he discovered the reality of the psyche, what he calls the objective psyche, i.e. that there are, like, you know, that there's like this autonomy in the psyche that's not just who we identify ourselves as being, and it actually is potentially informed by wisdom. And so if he, for example, got in the clutches of psychiatrists and if he were to describe what his experiences were, you know, they would have medicated his experiences out of existence and all of his, you know, the whole discovery of the actual imaginal realm and the reality of the psyche, which many people feel is the most important discovery of the 20th century in psychology, which is most people don't even know about that. So I just wanted to point that out, that, you know, here is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, all-time psychiatrist who himself was hearing voices, and it wasn't pathological.
Let's go to CJ, state of Washington, first-time caller. Hi, CJ, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Always had something to say for everything that you ever put on all your shows, but I felt the need to call tonight because I myself am a disabled veteran and had a spiritual awakening experience very similar to the one that your guest talked about this evening. And I just wanted to confirm that, and also hopefully get some resources to some help that I can get with coping with that.
Did this awakening change you, CJ?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It changed my perspective, first and foremost.
What do you recommend, Seth? Where do people go if they're listening to the show right now and they, too, think they need some help?
Yeah, I do recommend at least they go to websites where they can meet and interact with people. They're listed on my website, but I'll mention the Icarus Project, and it's the IcarusProject.net, because that actually has a forum, unlike David's website, where you can read about many other mental patients who are fighting against psychiatry. This one you can actually post and get in conversations with people. So that's the Icarus, Icarus Project.net. I have the links to those things on my website, which is sethhfarber.com.
Okay, very good.
And I mean, I could mention other things. There aren't enough yet, you know. They're developing, but there aren't enough because there's so many people suffering and psychiatrists now. Even if they want to be helpful, there's such pressure on them to become drug pushers and spend 15 minutes with someone rather than listen to them for an hour. Let alone doing the kind of creative stuff Paul does is what, you know, that was what people in the hearing voices. Now, some people believe that the hearing voices are real spirits. Makes sense to me. Whether they are or not, having a dialogue with them could be productive. It's part of spiritual, enlarging one's spiritual realm.
What about some sinister group beaming voices into someone electronically?
Yeah, I had a client who claimed that the... I mean, I'm sure that happened. She had all the research on it. She was a graduate she got her master's at Stanford University, and then really her life went down the drain. She was so convinced. I wasn't really convinced that the CIA was, but, you know, but I guess it had. She certainly sent me enough research to convince me that it does happen with some cases through microwaves or something. People start hearing things. I don't know if they're always voices or not, and it's not a result of any process of awakening or enlarging their spirituality. It's a result of some government agency trying out new mind control.
Could I say one thing?
I don't know how common that is. The majority of people that hearing voices that consulted me, I don't think that was happening to them, but I'm sure it's happening, has happened to some people.
Paul?
Yeah, I just wanted to say to the person on the phone that, I think of myself, when I got out of the last mental hospital in 82, and everybody, all of my friends and family, they had completely subscribed to that, that I was mentally ill and all that. And it couldn't have been more obvious to me, that I was having a spiritual awakening. And what I discovered was the profound importance of connecting with other people who understood, who I didn't have to translate to, but who actually through their own experience could really, have had similar experiences. And, the fact that I was able to find people like that helped me enormously. Because if not, then you're just isolated, and then you can get into your own head in a way that can actually, one can go a little crazy in that way.
No, yeah, one of the person I interviewed, Ed Whitney, I interviewed six people and one alternative psychiatrist. Paul was one. And Ed Whitney had all these amazing experiences, not more amazing than Paul's, but similar kinds of experiences where he felt he was the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, which is one of the themes of my book, had really dawned. It had finally come. And he was in an ecstatic state. And then, he came down and he went through highs and lows. He had what he called the dark night of the soul, in which he felt he was going through hell. But he said the worst experience after he was in a kind of not San Francisco, but that other place south of San Francisco. I can't think of it right now, where they have the big college. It's kind of a cultural town. Paul probably knows what I'm thinking. I can't think of it right now, but. So it was a countercultural environment. It was the 70s, so there was tolerance for that. He kept getting locked up. But after the whole thing was over.
San Jose, maybe?
What?
Maybe
San
Jose?
Yeah, yeah. What?
San Jose?
No, but it's a San.
Okay.
Anyway, he went to the psychiatrist. He wanted to talk about it, and the psychiatrist said to him, what you had was a biochemical disorder. By the way, Ed Whitney went in there. He knows all about biochemical disorders because he had been a practicing, not a psychiatrist, but a practicing physician for 10 years. So he knew enough about the brain that to be convinced that what he had was a genuine spiritualist. He said when that guy, the psychiatrist, the head of that, told him, all it was the aberrant chemistry going wrong, he was plunged into the deepest state of despair that he felt like committing suicide. And that was, he said, was more traumatic than all the ups and downs he'd had in his altered state of consciousness. And fortunately for him, at that time, he in whatever it was, he was able to find a psychiatrist who, this was still the 70s, who someone recommended. He was able to talk to him. The guy said to him, no, that wasn't aberrant chemistry. What you went through was the dark night of the soul. St. John talks about it, and you can read about it in the writings of Evelyn Underhill, the great Christian mystics. So there are highs and there are lows. But the worst thing you can do is to tell someone they have a pathological that it's mental illness, and they've been doing it over and over again, and that's how that's one of the ways they wittingly or unwittingly undermine people. So people have to create their own, go to, on my website, I have links to Mind Freedom. And there has to be more things created in order to save the planet, because I believe there are many people like Paul who's reached this degree of, and what I would say, enlightenment. There are many others, and they can make a tremendous contribution to expanding the culture's sense of what's possible.
Absolutely. Marguerite in Mesa, Arizona. Hi.
Hi, Seth. Hi, Paul. Hi, George. Thank you so much for for this topic. You answered some of the questions that I had, but my mother was diagnosed with mental illness back in the 70s, put on a lot of antipsychotic medications and even to the point of electroshock therapy. And I became very interested in this field and had an instructor in the 70s for my abnormal psychology class who's talking about this very subject. And I guess my question is, I personally am very psychic, intuitive, and a medium. And how many and what percentage of people do you think are diagnosed with something other than enlightenment? And what can we do as individuals to bring more awareness to this?
Yeah, that's such a good question.
Well, that's why I wrote my book, and that's why I'm going on the radio to try to make people more aware. But the problem is how do you make psychiatrists? If you're asking about particularly psychiatrists, that's a big problem because they don't want to become aware. Because in the Vermont study, the data shows that those who are getting money from the drug companies, it's one-third, this was 10 years ago, they get consultation fees from the drug companies. That used to be prohibited by the American Psychiatric Association. Now they're making an extra $100,000, $200,000, half a million a year. Jeez. And they do prescribe drugs, psychiatric drugs, more often. So how are you going to get, they have a vested interest in keeping people on the drugs. So I don't know the answer to how are you going to, if the answer is how are you going to make psychiatrists more aware and open to this, That is the million-dollar question.
Right, and
how to make ordinary people who are spiritually inclined more aware of it is by telling people. You know, this is not my first book. My first book also told the others are kind of esoteric, but I wrote one which I was hoping to get the church to come along and see that it's not Christian to tell people they're mentally ill, that this is really a mystical experience. Well, I didn't get far with that, did you? What? Yeah, I didn't get too far.
Unholy Madness for that one, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then I subtitled The Church's Surrender to Psychiatry. I couldn't get one Christian magazine to even reveal the book. I got a couple rave reviews by some very bright ex-mental patients who understood what I was saying. People I met who were in Christians, not fundamentalists, but I was involved with the Russian Orthodox Church, so I knew people like that. I knew some Mennonites who were.
Well, it's a subject that truly needs more and more investigating, to be sure. Seth, thank you so much, Paul. You as well for staying on a little longer than we had agreed to. Appreciate that. I'll be back in a moment with the open lines on Coast to Coast AM.